In total, 23 people died when British European Airways Flight 609 crashed on its third attempt to take off from a slush-covered runway at the old Munich airport. On board the plane at the time were supporters, journalists and the whole of the Manchester United team nicknamed the Busby Babes. Over the next hour, we're going to hear a blow-by-blow account of what happened in Germany by the only player still alive to tell the story.
Little Johnny Berry said, I know what you're all freaking laughing at here, we're all going to get killed. And Liam Whelan sitting there in his seat said, well, if it happens, I'm ready.
And I looked at him and I thought, what are you going on at, Bill?
It just went straight down the runway and it didn't stop.
We'll speak to friends and relatives who'll tell us how they coped with Manchester's biggest peacetime tragedy.
I'm not a great religious man, but I was at the side of my bed having a prayer and all of a sudden my uncle comes running up and says, he's alive, he's alive.
It was just terrible from there, terrible. Thursday got killed. We was getting married on the Saturday.
8 United players died in the disaster, 23 in total. We'll discover how it still haunts many of the survivors.
I don't understand why I was okay, you know, and they were killed.
We got home and I should never have played football.
It affects everybody. Everybody.
We'll look at the legacy of the Busby Babes and speak to United's players and staff of today.
It started the origins of the romance of Manchester United, really.
That is embedded in you at an early age, the history and the heritage of Manchester United, and of course a big part of that was Samat's achievement and of course Munich.
And we've also tracked down the other Busby Babes whose dads didn't live to see them.
I don't think he knew if it was a boy or a girl at that time, but I think he was quite excited about the possibility of having a family, obviously.
He knew I'd come in, and then when that happened tragically, I mean, you just got to live with what situation was at the time.
Now, in these days of football superstars, huge wages and wall-to-wall TV coverage, it's probably hard for people to understand just how different the game was back in the 1950s. In England, there was a maximum wage of £20, and most players were actually paid less than the majority of working-class fans who came to see them. Some of them even had other jobs outside the game. It was different for the players then, but for the fans, really, it was even more of a way of life than it is these days. You didn't have the option of going to watch the game on a big screen at your local pub, and there weren't loads of other things you could be doing on a Saturday afternoon either. Here's Sir Bobby Charlton.
It was a different game. It was the gigantic game that it is now, but it wasn't recognised as such. You know, today everybody say, "Well, football is it touches so many people. Its contribution to life is enormous." In those days, football had to get in the queue with everybody else. You know, cricket, rugby. Whatever sport you played, you know, football got no more attention in the media, for example, you know, than any of the others.
These social conditions set the backdrop for what was to emerge one of the most exciting football teams ever seen in the UK. From there, the story centres around Matt Busby. He'd taken over at United in 1946, just over a year after the end of the Second World War. At the time, he was just 37, but he immediately put his mark on the side, leading them to the runners-up spot in the league. United were then runners-up as well in 1948, 1949 and 1951, before finally winning the championship in 1952. By this stage, his side was beginning to show its age, though, and a new set of players had to be found. Busby was expected to splash the cash on building a new team from scratch, but surprised a lot of people by gradually replacing the older players with kids as young as 16 and 17. This young team was soon nicknamed the Busby Babes and didn't waste much time in winning their first trophy. They won the league in both 1956 and 1957 and were runners-up to Aston Villa in the 1957 FA Cup final. Busby's team started the 1957-58 season then full of confidence, and by February had reached the fifth round of the FA Cup and were also challenging for the title. Their second European campaign was also going well. They'd beaten Shamrock Rovers and Dukla Prague to set up a quarter-final clash with Yugoslavian champions Red Star Belgrade. Like today's competition, the game was played over two legs. The first at Old Trafford ended 2-1 to United thanks to goals from Bobby Charlton and Eddie Coleman. They then flew over to Belgrade to try and finish the job off. Winger Albert Scanlon.
The actual game itself, I thought the first half hour was some of the best football ever played by a Manchester United side that I was involved with. I thought the second half, when the lads were under the collar, was one of the best defensive actions I've ever seen.
The game ended 3-3, meaning United were through to their second successive European Cup semi-final, this time against the mighty AC Milan. But most of the team wouldn't be alive to see it.
You're listening to the story of the Munich air disaster, Manchester's darkest hour, on Key 103.
The plane carrying 17 players, 4 United staff members, 9 journalists, 4 crew, as well as 10 other people, took off from Belgrade the morning after the game. The initial takeoff was delayed for an hour because United player Johnny Berry had lost his passport. They then had to make a brief schedule stop to refuel at Munich Airport. Here's goalkeeper Harry Gregg.
I was asleep and they woke us up, fasten your safety belts. I looked out the window, it was snowing, and we hardly seen the ground till we were near it. It wasn't snowing heavily. We went in, bought a packet of cigarettes, Jackie Blanche flour, called back 2 or 3 minutes later, got on the aircraft, and she started off down the runway. I just looked out my window, watching the wheels and watching the big telescopic rod expand. There was nothing untoward at all, apart from a little bit of, a fair bit of snow. And I just, out of curiosity, I watched these expand. And then all of a sudden, I watched the wheels lock and unlock, and she started to spin. And I heard the thump from behind me on my right shoulder, and the poor steward, Tom Cable, threw himself out of the galley, or was thrown out, and threw himself into a three-seater beside a woman and child, and strapped himself in, and the poor fellow was terrified. He got the plane stopped, and they come on, and they said it was a technical hitch, we would go back and go again.
Defender Bill Foulkes.
We came back to the terminal and had a cup of coffee and then went back out very quickly. I was very uncomfortable. I had a feeling that there was something not quite right, that's all. Whether it was a premonition, I don't know.
Albert Scanlon picks up the story.
And everybody went off again. And for some unknown reason, Mark Jones bought St Christopher medal. And we all trooped out again, 5-10 minutes wait. People inside the plane started changing seats. We lost, there was Kenny Morgans, Billy Foulkes, David Pegg, myself. David left us to change seats. And a few opposite on the other side, the lads that were playing cards, it was 8 of them. One or two started changing seats. A couple of reporters started changing seats. And we went again and the same thing happened.
2 failed attempts then, but still the pilot was determined to get the players off the ground, so they got back onto the plane for a third time.
The third time, I think everybody by then was maybe a little, not worried, but concerned maybe a little bit.
And we started off, and this time I was reading a book. It was called The Whip by Roger MacDonald. And it was one of those early days pornography. And I thought, Christ, if I get killed reading this book, I'll go to hell. So I put the book away. We sat up down the runway again. I watched the rods all the time. And I watched them, and Johnny Berry coughed. I looked across diagonally at Roger Byrne, and where I was a bit worried, when I looked at Roger, I laughed. His face was contorted. I thought, somebody here more frightened than I am. And somebody laughed, and little Johnny Berry said, I know what you're all freaking laughing at here. We're all going to get killed. And Liam Whelan, sitting in the aisle seat, said, well, if it happens, I'm ready.
Tragically, those words were to come true as the plane set off.
It just went straight down the runway and it didn't stop. It didn't get off the floor either.
The first bump we had, first thud of the aircraft when it hit the ground. Then the second one, which was even worse, you know. And I thought, well, if one more and this is, you know, this is it. That's what I felt, you know.
I see us hit the perimeter fence and then you're just thinking, well, you know, keep your head down.
I felt, you know, this is going to be the end. And it did, it was, it just...
Daylight, it's darkness, it sparks, and something hit the back of my head. I felt something got my nose, I felt blood, and all of a sudden, that was no screaming. It was just tearing the metal from daylight to darkness.
As the plane came to a halt, one of the wings and part of the tail had fallen off. The house it had crashed into was on fire, and part of the fuselage had hit a wooden hut, causing a truck filled with tyres and fuel parked inside to explode.
I think I'm dead. Just lay there. And then I saw a shaft of light off to my right, way above me. I thought, Christ, I'm not dead. I was afraid to touch the top of my head because I thought it would come off like a hard-boiled egg. And I reached down to unfasten my safety belt and didn't realise that I didn't have a belt. But I couldn't relate to the darkness where it was daylight. I started to crawl to the shaft of light and I put my head out through the hole in the top of the aircraft and I seen the first dead man I'd seen. And it was Bert Wally, the youth team coach, and he was lying below me about 6 or 7 feet down. There wasn't a mark on him. Wearing the previous cup finals grey suit, and I couldn't get out the hole, so I turned around my backside and kicked the hole a bit bigger, and I dropped out, and just a terrible hiss and a burn where there'd been an engine before, there was no wing. And I stood there for a second or two, and there was 5 people running away in the distance, the 2 stewardesses a fellow called Rogers, a radio operator, for want of a better word, and Peter Hard and Ted Elliard, two journalists, and they shouted, "Run, it's going to explode, run, it's going to explode." And just with that came brave man, Jim Thane, the pilot who lived. He came around what was left of the cockpit, and he shouted, "Run, you stupid bastard, it's going to explode." And he had a little fire extinguisher in his hand. And then he turned around and ran back the way he'd come.
Defender Bill Foulkes.
When I became conscious, I felt, oh, we're okay. You know, we've survived, you know. And I looked around, and Captain Thane just, he was knocked on the window. The engine on our side was smoking, and he just knocked on the window and told me to get out of there. Next thing I saw was Harry Gregg coming from behind the aircraft with a baby in his arms. I didn't realise there was a baby on board.
I found the romper suit belonging to this child, trying to trace the noise, but there was nothing in it, and I was relieved. And then eventually I found the baby, and I crawled out, it cut around its eyes and things, and I ran after these people and shouted, "Take us off me." And Rogers, the operator, came back and took it off me and took off with it. And I went back again, and eventually I didn't find the mother. The mother found me. She just exploded in the darkness. And she would be my age, actually, around my age at the time. And I couldn't describe it. Her face was completely flat. She had no features. And it was black, as cold black as a fireplace, back of a fireplace. I got her to the hole, and I didn't take her out. I put my feet in the middle of her back and just kicked her through the hole, and she kept going. I then went and I tried to get Ray Wood out, and I couldn't get him out. He was trapped. I then found Albert Scanlon, and Albert made me sick. Albert was, his head was completely and totally cracked like a hard-boiled egg in two places. Easy talking about it now, yeah, it's not. Blood came out of his ears and everything. And I couldn't get him out. I come out of the aircraft. I climbed over what was left of a stump of a wing, and as I climbed over that, I found Charlton and Dennis Violet lying half in and half out of what was left of the front of the aircraft. There was nothing left of the aircraft. And I would say, no, I tell a lot of people didn't come home. I never thought we're living or dead. I just grabbed them by the waistband of their trousers and pulled them away through the snow. Dennis Violet had a terrible cut in the back of his head, and that's when I discovered how bad it was. I got round what was left of the aircraft, and there was a house with a quarter of the roof off it burning, and there was a petrol dump 50, 60 yards away with the rest of the plane and the fuel dump. It was going off like a bomb. And I'd started shouting, Blanche, whether it's from childhood, Jackie Blanchflower. And eventually I found Jackie, and he was crying, and the heat was melting the snow, and he didn't realise. He tells me afterwards he did. Roger Byrne was lying across him, and he was crying. He was paralysed. He broke his back. And when I looked, Jackie's right arm was hanging off, and he hadn't even noticed it. I took my tie off and tied it around the stump of his arm. He didn't even notice, and Roger, not a mark on him. And then a van turned up, a blue Volkswagen van with a side door and a back door. A fellow turned up with a hypodermic syringe, but every time, and a black bag and a tweed coat, every time this thing exploded, he took and run. Till eventually he slipped his arms with the hypodermic syringe up in the air. Ordinary people came from across the fields from a village and helped get the bodies and people into vans and get them off to hospital. That includes me. And there was no firefighters, and there was no fire engines, and there was no nothing. So all that, the efficiency of the German people, good luck to them, that had these firefighters coming down the runway after the plane. I never saw any of them. There was nobody there.
Harry Gregg, myself, Dennis Violet, Bobby came too. And they were all lying there, you know. And Bobby just got up. Dennis got up out of... Bobby was in his seat, and still in his seat, and got up and then sat in the truck, in the van, and then we just drove off back to the hospital.
21 people had died at the scene, including 7 players. They were Jeff Bent, Roger Byrne, Eddie Coleman, Mark Jones, David Pegg, Tommy Taylor and Liam Billy Whelan. One man was still missing, though, the team's youngest player, Kenny Morgans.
I blacked out. And that was a Thursday, about 3 o'clock, and about half past eight to about 9 o'clock, German reporters went back to the plane, and they were looking for something in the plane, and I was still in the plane. They'd forgotten about me.
Back here in Manchester, news began to filter in of the tragedy. Nobby Stiles was a United trainee.
I got on the bus and I went into Piccadilly. I bought a Manchester Evening Chronicle. As I got it and I looked, I didn't know. there was 8 photographs on the front and they were all dead. I'd remember that day like anything.
Also in Manchester was Sandy Busby, the son of manager Matt Busby, who was seriously injured.
A pal of mine, Paddy Kennedy, and I were coming back about 4 o'clock in the afternoon from training. Paddy turned around, it was Victoria Station in Manchester in them days. Paddy turned around and he said, have you seen the placards? I said, what? He says, United in a plane crash. So I dashed to the cubicle, the telephone cubicle, phoned home, and an auntie was on the end of the line, and she frantically shouted out, Sandy, get home, get home. And I thought, oh, this is serious, you know. My mother was in a sort of a semi-coma. She kept on, she just sat there looking into the fire, because it started coming through, so-and-so's dead. And it was all faithful people that it was coming through. I'm not a great religious man, but I was at the side of my bed, having a prayer, and all of a sudden my uncle shouted, comes running up the stairs, he's alive, he's alive.
In the hospital in Munich alongside Sir Matt, several other lives hung in the balance. Albert Skeller was unconscious for 3 weeks. Johnny Berry and Jackie Blanchflower were also seriously ill, and star player Duncan Edwards was getting worse by the day. David Meek worked for the Manchester Evening News, whose reporter Tom Jackson had also died in the crash.
There was certainly a lot of focus on Duncan Edwards because he seemed to epitomise the spirit of the Busby Babes. There was a sort of daily bulletin on his condition, which was always critical, and to a certain extent that was the focus on the team. And when he died, I think 15 days after the crash, a lot of the spirit that had sustained the supporters that went as well. So it was a very flat period when he died.
United's best player had died, and a week later, co-pilot Ken Raymond also lost his fight for life, bringing the final death toll to 23.
This is Key 103, remembering the Munich air disaster 50 years on. With Matt Haslam.
Manchester was now in a state of mourning. The bodies of the victims were flown home before being collected by families. Thousands turned out to line the streets as funerals and memorial services were held all over the country.
I think the people of Manchester, not just United fans, but the people of Manchester had taken the Busby Babes team to their hearts. And so they were stunned. Coming in to work on the train, it was funereal.
United fan Tom Clare remembers what the atmosphere was like as the bodies arrived back here in Manchester.
I was stood here in what was Warwick Road then. It was round about 8:30 in the evening, as I recall it, when the hearses started to come down, and it was deathly quiet, and Warwick Road then was all cobbled. And as the hearses turned in, you know, you could hear the sound of the wheels on the cobble, and people's emotions got the better of them, and there was a lot of weeping and sniffling, but it was just so deadly quiet, and the hearses passed and people's emotions got the better of them, and they turned left onto the, what was then the forecourt, and they came down towards the gymnasium, and that's where they were placed overnight. It was a very, very sad and moving occasion.
Manchester Evening News reporter David Meek.
They were then concerned with what's going to happen to Manchester United as a football club. Was it going to go out of existence? Would they be able to field a team for the next game, which of course was that weekend? Well, that was postponed immediately, but they played, I think it was 13 days after the crash, which is not a long time. And that was a cup tie against Sheffield Wednesday.
The cup game ended 3-1 to the Reds and was accompanied by a message on the front of the programme saying that United will go on. Sentiments echoed by the now recovering manager, Matt Busby, who a couple of weeks later had this message for fans from his hospital bed.
You will be glad, I'm sure, to know that the remaining players here and myself are now considered out of danger. And this can be attributed to the wonderful treatment and attention given us by Professor Maurer and his wonderful staff, who are with you today as guests of the club.
Busby then was putting on a brave face, but speaking to this station shortly before his death in 1994, he admits he struggled to recover.
It took me quite a bit of time to accept the terrible disaster that had happened. First of all, when I came round after a couple of weeks, I was in a bad way. My dear wife was with me, and at that time, when she said, I said the names of the players, and she nodded her head. They were either dead, or they'd been killed, or they were alive. From there, I said, I'm not going back to Manchester United again. I'm not going to have anything to do with football. And my wife said, I think probably the players who have passed away, who have been killed in the crash, would want you to carry on. And it put a germ in my mind, and I started saying, well, perhaps he's right. And of course, eventually I did. I realised that I had to go back and do something. I felt as though it had to go on. Life had to go on, and this is the way it happened. And of course, from there, I felt as though we should get down to the creating a club whereby it was a credit to the people who had passed on.
While Busby set about rebuilding his team, the survivors and families of the victims set about rebuilding their lives. For those who survived, some didn't have a chance to grieve, though. Unbelievably, goalkeeper Harry Gregg and defender Bill Foulkes, who, as we've heard, were so involved in the crash and subsequent rescue, managed to play in the cup game with Sheffield Wednesday just 13 days afterwards. Bill admits he doesn't know how he coped.
It was worse for me, actually. It made me captain, which put pressure on me. Then I was working at the time. I worked in the coal mine. I used to play part-time with United and train part-time with United, although I knew what to do to get myself fit.
How did it actually change your approach to life? You said that you had these different roles afterwards, but did you appreciate life more afterwards? Do you appreciate life more now?
Oh, yes. Definitely. You know, if you're seeing guys you've lived with and played with and die, you know, it makes you think.
When the Germans eventually discovered the team's youngest player, Kenny Morgans, he'd somehow only suffered minor injuries, but it was something that he never really recovered from.
We got home and I should never have played football for the next year, and because of the players that had died, I mean, Jimmy Murphy came down and said, I got to go back because he had no team and he had no wingers. So I went back and I played up to the cup final. Then on the Saturday of the cup final, Jimmy thought that the atmosphere and it'll be too much for me at Wembley. And he didn't play me at Wembley. And I was hoping that he would have because I wanted to win the cup for the players that had died. So I was a bit upset about that. And then it took me years then to get back in because I just missed the players.
Did you in some ways lose your passion for football? Did it kind of put life into context or football into context?
Yes, I didn't. I just missed the players. I mean, I used to love to train. I was in Diggs and, I mean, three doors up there was Duncan Edwards and then five doors up there was Tommy Taylor. So, I mean, for 3 months I used to go to work with them.
Did a lot of the players feel resentment towards what happened?
No. It was just the weather was so bad. I mean, you couldn't see a hand in front of you. Three times you tried to take off. I mean, it was just the weather and the snow. I mean, they took the ice off the plane twice. I mean, I don't blame anybody.
Kenny didn't blame anyone, but initial investigation said that pilot error was to blame, but subsequently it was found to have been caused by the build-up of slush at the end of the runway. Despite this conclusion, the German airport authorities took legal action against Captain James Tain, claiming that he'd taken off without de-icing the wings. Tain was only cleared 10 years later in 1968, when a photo of the aircraft with snow on the wings was proven to be inaccurate. Bill Foulkes thinks the pilot had no choice anyway.
Why did we go? You know, why was there? I know that Matt was under pressure from the FA, get the players back on Thursday, you know. And this was the day, you know, because the weather was bad. And I thought we were going to stay in Germany and then get back.
From blame to guilt, Sir Bobby Charlton is the most high-profile survivor of the disaster. He escaped almost unhurt, whereas teammates around him died. He's been racked with guilt for the last 50 years. He was one of the players who switched seats just before the third attempted takeoff.
The old Elizabethan aeroplane had half of the seats faced the front, half the seats faced the back. And all the ones that were facing the back, they were the ones that survived.
Charlton went on to become one of United and England's greatest ever players, but to this day, the memory of that afternoon in Munich 50 years ago will never leave him.
I think about it a lot,
I think about how lucky I've been and how unlucky they were. Because every young lad is a footballer who has they have dreams, you know, and they want to be, they want to do well in the chosen profession, and they want to be, they want to feel as though this is where they should be, and of course it's snatched away from them.
Is the Munich disaster still the what you would consider as the defining moment in your own life?
Probably, yes. Of course. They don't happen every day, accidents like that. So, yeah, it does.
How has it actually changed you as a person, though? Has it completely transformed you from the person you were before to the person you are?
I don't know. I don't enjoy flying as much as I used to. And traveling. I'm quite happy at the moment, quite satisfied, really.
Now, I mentioned earlier that winger Albert Scanlon was unconscious for 3 weeks after the crash. He'd fractured his skull but was somehow able to make a full recovery and was actually back in action at the start of the following season. To this day, though, it still haunts him as well.
You change because every time you went out, somebody pointed a finger at you and says, oh, he was in the Munich air crash. You still say it to this day. You in a Munich air crash, yeah. But you didn't play, you did play. What, you finish up arguing, so you just say, yeah, that's it.
A lot of players have spoken about the guilt, that, you know, they survived and others didn't. Do you carry the same kind of
no,
guilt?
No, I carry no guilt whatsoever. Bobby didn't have a mark on him. He had a cut on his ear. Bobby had gone in 5 days, so he wasn't in the hospital. So it affects everybody.
Goalkeeper Harry Gregg, as we've heard, was the biggest hero of the rescue operation, yet the crash had such an effect on him that he wasn't actually able to speak to the relatives of the victims until 40 years later.
I couldn't face it, and then eventually my daughter spoke to Joy Byrne, and she spoke to me, and she said, why have you been punishing yourself for 40 years? I said, Joy, I couldn't speak to you. I couldn't do it. There was nothing I could do. And it was the same with Mrs. Pegg, and it was the same with Mrs. Edwards. And Mrs. Edwards sadly said to my daughter, do you know, love, if my son had been sitting with your dad, he'd be here today. That's not true. But for years, I couldn't handle it. I just couldn't handle it. I got sick of the hypocrisy of the place. I got sick at times of Old Trafford as a player when I'm playing with so-called great players. And wishing fact is fact. And they're saying when they did some little thing, we won a cup or something. We did it for the lads at Munich. Cobblers.
This is the story of the Munich air disaster, Manchester's darkest hour, on Key 103.
While it was hell for the survivors, for the victims' families, it was even worse. Remember, 23 people died in total in the tragedy. For the people back here, the pain was unimaginable. Mark Jones was among the players who died. His story is among the most tragic as well. His mum had died shortly before the crash, and his sister was due to get married just 2 days afterwards. 50 years on, I caught up with Irene in Yorkshire, where her brother remains a local hero.
It was just terrible from there. Terrible. I was getting married in 2 days. He got killed on the Wednesday. It was we were getting married on the Saturday, and it was, do we get married or don't we? After a lot of soul searching, I was only 21, excuse me. And I thought, if we do, it'll be done with. If we don't, he still won't be here, and my mother wouldn't have been here. So I did the hardest thing and got married. Mark's wife, she said, Irene, get married. I said I weren't getting married in white, I was going to get married in the suit that I'd had for my mother's funeral. And he said, not likely. You're getting married in the dress what my mother's seen you in. And that's what I did.
It's obviously really hard to talk about it all these years on, but 50 years on, you're still married, and that's a testament, yes, to yourself and what you did on that day.
You see, when I go back, I'm 21. I'm 71, but I'm 21, because he'll forever be 24. He was a lovely, lovely person.
Mark Jones' story didn't end there, though. He had a young son, and his wife was actually pregnant when he died. Lynn Hargreaves, as she is now, has never been interviewed in her life until now. I managed to track her down working in Marks and Spencer's in Barnsley.
It's upsetting, really, because, I mean, I've lived with a legend since I were born. I mean, my granddad took my place, you know, took my dad's place. He looked after me, you know, my mum's dad. He were there for me. He were like my second dad. He brought me up, you know, and I was very, very close to him. But there again, he told me everything about my dad. It was never, ever forgotten, you know. As soon as I were born, like I said, as soon as I were able to know, my mum told me all about it. But obviously, when these things come up, it's very upsetting.
Obviously, what you've never had, you don't miss, if you like. But was it strange growing up knowing that, you know, your dad had never seen you and had died in such a kind of public way, in such a tragic way?
Yeah. It were really upsetting because I really did want to know him. I mean, like I said, everything that were told about him, he were a great man. And he were a kind man. And he were just, he loved football, he loved my mum. And obviously I didn't get that love because he knew I'd come in. Don't get me wrong, he knew I was on my way. And then when that happened tragically, I mean, there was nothing I could do. You know, I just got to live with what situation was at the time.
Lynn wasn't the only baby born after the crash. I managed to find the son of Captain Roger Byrne. Roger Jr. was a ball boy at Old Trafford in the 1970s and now works as a teacher in Swindon. This is his story.
My mum was actually pregnant with me when my dad was killed, so I was actually born in the October of 1958, and he was obviously killed on February the 6th.
Was he aware that she was pregnant?
Yes, I believe he was. So he was obviously looking forward to having a child. I don't think he knew if it was a boy or a girl at that time, but I think he was quite excited about the possibility of having a family, obviously.
Do you ever have to tell people who you are?
It's amazing that particularly people do recognise the name and they do make the link. It tends to be older people now. But it's surprising the number of people that still make that connection, which is quite remarkable, really, 50 years on.
Now, we must remember that it wasn't just players who died in the tragedy. Here's David Meek, formerly of the Manchester Evening News.
There were 8 journalists also killed, and there were only 9 reporters on, and the 9th, Frank Taylor of the News Chronicle, was very critically injured. It was a long time before he worked again. It was all the number ones who were killed. They were number ones were the people travelling with the team.
One of the journalists was also a Manchester City legend, goalkeeper Frank Swift. As a player, he'd spent the whole of his career playing for the Blues, making 376 appearances and winning the FA Cup in 1934 and the league title in 1937. He was also England's number one during and after the Second World War. Swift had retired from the game in 1950 and took up a career in journalism. He was working for the News of the World when the plane crashed. He was pulled alive from the wreckage but died on his way to hospital. The bitterness and sadness remain then, and still does in many ways, for the survivors and relatives of the victims. But on the pitch, the tragedy seemed to galvanise the club and Matt Busby. He gradually rebuilt the team around Munich survivors, including Bobby Charlton and Bill Foulkes, bringing through youngsters like Nobby Styles and David Sadler, and of course George Best. He also made signings like Paddy Crerand, Alex Stepney and Dennis Law.
There was always that extra pressure on you to do well, and when I came back, we didn't get off to a good start. In fact, we nearly got relegated that year. But fortunately, we went on to win the FA Cup. So that was a blessing. And then from then on, we started to come. And we were fortunate that in that next year, of course, the great George Best came through. I knew I was coming back to something special. I didn't realise how special it would be. That would, that would come later.
Not too much later, though, the Reds' new-look team, captained by Sir Bobby Charlton, were again crowned league champions in 1965 and 1967. The following year, 10 years after the Munich air disaster, Manchester United achieved the dream which many had thought had died on that runway in Germany. Matt Busby's side beat Benfica by 4-1 at Wembley Stadium to win the European Cup. In the years that followed, the success of the Busby era wasn't repeated. He resigned a year after their European Cup success and they were relegated from the top flight in 1974, courtesy of Dennis Law's famous back heel. They returned in their first attempt, but apart from the FA Cup wins in 1977, 83 and 85, the era saw United fall from their position as England's number one club. That was until the arrival of Alex Ferguson. Like Matt Busby before him, he'd grown up in an industrial town in western Scotland and took over when the club was in a state of relative chaos. Both were very single-minded as well and wanted to base their success on youth development. development.
What I felt, and I'm sure Sir Matt felt the same, you get far more satisfaction in producing your own players. Without doubt, you get a bigger degree of loyalty. You build up, it's in a better way, you build up a sort of a family base.
Fergie's United players of today, with Sir Bobby Charlton a regular face in the dressing room, are well aware of what the 50th anniversary of the disaster means to the club and the people of Manchester.
We had a good talk with him the other day about this coming up the centenary, and he gave us some words of wisdom and talked about a few of his experiences. And you kind of come out of the room thinking, blooming hell, man, you forget that he's the fine example of a living legend.
He's such a gentleman. He's always got time for you. He tells you stories. He's always supporting you. Never a bad word coming from his mouth. And when he speaks, everyone just keeps quiet and listens.
50 years on from the disaster, the emotions are still stronger than ever for those involved in the tragedy. In total, 23 people died of the 44 people on board. Sir Alex Ferguson read the names out in a special service at Manchester Cathedral 10 years ago.
That terrible day, we lost the following players: Roger Byrne, Jeff Bent, Eddie Coleman, Mark Jones, David Pegg, Tommy Taylor, Liam, Billy Whelan and Duncan Edwards. We also lost club secretary Walter Krickmer, first team trainer Tom Curry, and coach Bert Walling. 8 journalists also died: Alf Clark, Don Davis, George Follows, Tom Jackson, Archie Ledbrooke, Henry Rose, Frank Swift, and Eric Thompson. 2 British European Airways crew also lost their lives: Captain Ken Raymond and Tommy Cable, and 2 other passengers, Bella Miklos and a supporter, Willie Satinoff, also died.
As for United themselves, the club are now a multi-billion pound international business with fans around the world. But anybody who thinks that the club is abandoning its roots just needs to take a look to the left of the East Stand at Old Trafford. There stands a clock with the words February the 6th, 1958, Munich, the time and the place of this city's biggest peacetime tragedy.